I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here today for Leonard Lopate. In 1986, a fire at Britain's Hampton Court Palace destroyed exquisite wood carvings by Grinling Gibbons, a 17th century master carver. The American carver David Easterly was brought in to recreate some of the lost work, and his new memoir, The Lost Carving, A Journey to the Heart of Making from Viking, is not only a chronicle of the year he spent at the palace, learning to replicate Gibbons' work, but also a meditation on the nature of creativity and the human impulse to make things by hand. Mr. Easterly also has a new show of his work opening tonight at the W.M. Brady Gallery in New York City, and I'm delighted to welcome him to the Leonard Lopate Show today.
Nice to be here.
Can you? I love stories about people who are going along one path and suddenly take another, and yours fits that idea. You were pursuing an academic career. Can you tell us what led you to the work of Grinling Gibbons?
Well, I was pursuing an academic career, although I have to say that there were dangerous signs along the way that perhaps I wasn't really cut out for it. I mean, for example, in the summers, instead of taking internships at publishing houses, for example, I got a team. I became a Teamsters member, Teamsters Union member, and worked at unloading boxcars and so on.
Not the usual thing for a graduate student.
Not the usual thing, no. But the swerve into my present life really happened one day when I was walking along Piccadilly in London with the woman who would later become my wife. We were headed to have tea with my parents. As a matter of fact, she was meeting them for the first time. And she didn't seem to be in a great hurry to arrive. In fact, she was dawdling. And suddenly she grabbed me by the arm and said, "Let's go see Grinling Gibbons." I guess I'd heard the name, but I honestly thought it was a friend of hers with an odd name. But in fact, she steered us into a beautiful Wren church we happened to be passing at that moment.
Christopher Wren,
Christopher
right?
Wren, yes, from the 1680s. We walked up the aisle. I looked up at the panel behind the altarpiece, and there were I saw extraordinary cascades of leaves and flowers and fruits and vegetables carved in wood, but wood carved with a breathtaking fluency and fineness and realism. And it turned out, of course, that Grinling Gibbons was Britain's greatest wood carver. So that was my moment.
Had you ever been interested in wood carving before?
No, not at all. Nothing in the arts in the least. As a matter of fact, I misinterpreted my own interest. I assumed, because I'd just come from the academic world, that my interest was an academic one and that what I should be doing is writing a book about Gibbons, which I indeed started doing, and then decided that you couldn't really understand how this amazing style developed unless you understood something about his tools and his materials. So just for fun, I went out and bought some carving chisels and some lime wood. And with the first stroke, the genie was out of the bottle. And actually, that was the real turning point. You know, we often have these aperçus, which I had when I saw the carving for the first time. I mean, I was seeing it was something with more than my eyes. It was my body and my mind together that was responding.
We just had a Zen master here who was talking about grokking something, and in a sense, it sounds like you grokked it.
That's
which is
exactly
you felt it,
it
with your whole
Absolutely.
Self.
Absolutely. It seemed to be saying something that couldn't be said in any other way, and it wasn't saying to the brain. It was saying to the entire organism. Obviously, I was responding to it in more than an academic way. The genie really came out of the bottle when I took my first stroke of with a carving chisel, because I found that it was a wonderful motion with carving. I mean, I imagine one would do it as one would make jewelry, sitting at a bench on a stool. But in fact, it forced me to my feet. The whole body moved. It was an intensely pleasurable experience. So then the Piccadilly woman and I retired to a cottage in Sussex, where for the next 8 years I taught myself to carve.
You know, you were someone who had gone to school, who had studied probably with extraordinary teachers, and here you made the decision to teach yourself.
Yes, it was partly because there was no one to teach me. Mm-hmm. I mean, the style, the Gibbons very high relief, spectacularly realistic style of carving was really dead as a doornail. There were some carvers who were doing repairs, but honestly, nobody else. And, you know, I think that's just as well, because my feeling is that all knowledge is self-taught at heart. And although a teacher will help you prevent you from making some mistakes, really, mistakes are important. I mean, it's vital to make mistakes. I made mistakes all the time. They're a great pedagogical device, a mistake.
And as a carver, the thing is, once you make a mistake, you then have to figure out what you do with it, because it's right there for you to look at.
Precisely. It's also a subtractive art. So if you make the kind of mistake that involves removing material, which you need later on, that's the classic mistake in subtractive art, then you're in trouble. Although occasionally you can turn mistakes to good. I mean, actually, disasters, when something breaks off, for example, can be great designers. Because what happens, for example, if you say you're doing a flower and you break a petal off, you can either leave it and it turns into natural damage, and actually the thing is much more lively, or you can carve the little stub that's left into a twisted petal, which looks better in the first than the first plan did.
You write about this in your book, and I found this a wonderful metaphor and idea, that the perfection that we imagine in our heads when we're creating something is less interesting than something that may be shaped or damaged or twisted in a way that suddenly it doesn't reflect what we had imagined in the first place, but it has a life to it that it didn't have
when
exactly. It was perfect.
Yes, I mean, there's... You know, I'd be hard-pressed to do a soundbite on what creativity is, but it seems to me that there are at least two kinds of creativity. The first comes when you have the plan, when you to create a plan, an outline, a plot summary, or whatever you're doing. That certainly creates requires a kind of creativity. But for me, the more interesting sort of creativity is the kind that's embedded in the act of making itself. And I discovered this very vividly at Hampton Court, I must say.
And at Hampton Court, you were being asked, and this is the place where there were Gibbons carvings above many of the door frames. And had you seen these before they were burned by the fire in 1986?
Yes, I had seen them. Mm-hmm. Yes, no, I was aware of them as a carver, and I always was astounded at the beauty of them. But it wasn't until I became involved in the restoration program. I mean, I'm not a restorer, but they asked me to write the specifications for the repair. So I got to look at Gibbons carvings for the first time, and it was an amazing experience, which changed my own carving. So I knew the carvings well and admired them from afar, yes.
I am speaking with David Easterly. He is the author of The Lost Carving, A Journey to the Heart of Making, and it's from Viking Press. So you had seen these carvings in Hampton Court, and you write about being in your workshop in New York City when you in New York State, not New York City, where when you heard about the fire that had happened.
Yes, it was actually Easter Monday in 1986, and It was a bad moment because, for one thing, I began to get telephone calls from my British friends saying that they were looking at television images of flames spurting through the ceiling of or through the roof of Hampton Court Palace. So I assumed that that all the carvings had been destroyed, but it turned out there was only one that was completely destroyed, and that's the one which I replaced. All we had was a glass plate photograph from the 1930s, which made the carving look absolutely flat as a pancake. It was very badly lit. So although the carving projected 6 or 8 inches, it was almost impossible to read the terrain. And the other thing that we had were three other carvings in the room which bore a similar shape to the one that was gone. So that's what I had to start with to evolve a design. And I did the best I could and began doing what one does when one makes anything, which is executing the design. But there came a moment when I realized that the design was only going to get me so far. And, you know, that's probably true with all designs, more than just this design, which was by its nature limited because the information was so slight. And it really happened one winter's evening when it was pitch dark outside, and I was working away in this beautiful courtier's apartment, which had been turned over to the at Hampton Court, which had been turned over to the carving workshop. And I was floundering. I found that I couldn't read the elevations of the carving correctly. I was making mistakes. And there I was staring at this half-formed kind of inchoate larva-like series of forms on my workbench. And then the most extraordinary thing happened. I mean, I can only describe it by saying that Grinling Gibbons walked in the door, or the assistant who carved it, or maybe the workroom time traveled back to 1698. Suddenly, I was seeing this half-form carving with the eyes of the man who carved it back 300 years ago. I could see the possibilities that it offered him, and which it was also offering me. I could see that that half-formed leaf could twist either this way or that way. I could see why he chose it to twist in that way rather than this way. In other words, I had this incredibly vivid vision of what it means to be creative in the process of making, which I take to be something that's essential to artistic creativity, but not only artistic creativity, but really any kind of creativity. It's been a kind of guiding point. I mean, certainly there are many kinds of art, which contemporary art, which do not regard this kind of creativity as important. A lot of conceptual art, for example. Execution is not important.
And in our age, making things with our hands is becoming more and more rare. So this kind of, I mean, what I'm hearing when you describe that experience is almost as if the wood itself was giving you its story.
Precisely. The wood and the forms, obviously I put the forms there, so I must have had something to do with it, but they seemed to take an independent life and to tell me what needed to be done with them.
You do something in 2013 now that is very unusual, in that you take physical things and turn them into art with your hands and your tools. Why do you keep doing this? What is it that it gives you that has allowed you to keep pursuing it for all these years?
Well, for one thing, the physical pleasures of carving should not be underestimated. It's carving is the most elemental of forms. It's like a metaphor for everything else. It's as if it were an emblem for later evolved forms of human activity. What you do with carving, if you're using your hands rather than a mallet, which I do with the soft wood that I usually use, one hand propels the chisel, the other hand holds the shaft of the chisel and holds it back. And it's precisely this dynamic tension which gives you control over the edge of the blade.
And that, so you're pushing against yourself.
You're pushing against yourself, precisely. Mm-hmm. When I first started, I thought, well, I'm going to push against the wood. But that's not what you do. You resist your impulse, or your propelling hand, with a force that's slightly greater than the force that the wood would resist it with. And when you overcome that force against your own muscles, then it gives you extraordinary control over the blade. So it's that dynamic tension which is, I find, very physically pleasurable, but also I find all kinds of illusions that I just couldn't stop thinking about. I mean, for example, think about Hamlet. Hamlet is divided within himself. One part is impelled to revenge, the other part is resisting this. And it's exactly that power, that internal tectonic pressure within his personality that gives him his power over the world. And, you know, whenever Hamlet's on stage, he is the dominant character. And I began to think that maybe this is something. A lot of people think that if you're a very creative, energetic person, that what you're doing is you're just imposing your will on the world. But really, it's more sophisticated than that. You're also ingesting the world and taking account of the world's resistance to your ideas and resolving those issues within yourself. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. It's complicated,
it
but
is complicated.
I can, in a sense, it's like I'm feeling it rather than thinking it from the idea of, you know, I'm a potter and I understand it that way too, of what you do in pottery is you don't just push the clay if you're on the wheel, because you'll push it right off the wheel. You actually have to push against yourself. And
precisely.
You,
that's what gives you control.
It does. Yes. And you have to understand mm-hmm. the material, but then also let it inform you and you shape it. So, and I think that that's, it's different with words. You know, you are both a carver and a writer. So would you, do you find that as you write, and I should let people know who you are who've just joined us. I'm speaking with David Esterly, who is both a master carver and a writer. He's written The Lost Carving, A Journey to the Heart of Making, which is from Viking. But when you write, do you find that there's that same tension?
That's an interesting question, because, I mean, is writing, for example, a subtractive art like carving, or is it an additive art like pottery?
Or both. Example?
Or both. Well, that's the idea.
You see. Yes.
I mean, obviously at the start, it's additive. You know, you write a sentence, you write another sentence, you write another sentence. You keep adding more material. But there's an old saying that writing is rewriting. Writing is rewriting. And if that's the case, and I think it is, it's also subtractive. You have a body of material, and then you cut away. You know, you cut away whole chapters if necessary. So I think it's both, probably. And indeed, I think most forms of making are both kinds of work. And that's why I find carving such a rich metaphor for everything. I mean, I always found, in my earlier book on Gibbons, that when I started writing about carving, I was writing about other things without intending to. It's a sort of symbol-rich universe that you're into, very elusive.
In this book, you begin by writing about your workroom upstate, where you look over a field that leads down to the river, and you talk about your workbench. Can you describe for us what that workbench looks like?
Well, there are 130 beautiful chisels on it, many of which are 100 years old. The older tools are actually better than the modern tools. I don't know why. I think the steel is more flexible. It's not like a stone carver's workbench, for example. They will have only a few tools, because with stone carving, you knock away the material. With carving, you slice into it, and you leave behind on the wood the shape of the gouge, which is really what most chisels are. They're sort of curved blades. And so if you're going to do very complicated surfaces, like flowers, for example, then you need many different tools. But they give me huge pleasure. I mean, they're just very beautiful objects in themselves.
And you write about how they're laid out so that you can grab them without even looking at them, which sounded very dangerous, to be grabbing something with a very sharp point.
Yes, well, I mean, long ago I memorized where every tool was. And also, interestingly, you put them down with the blades toward you, because if you were to put them down with the blade away from you, you tend to jab the blade into some other tool. So you carefully give the blade a sort of flip, give the tool a flip, and you put it down that way. But no, they're like soldiers lined up, your little helpers who have been with you for years and years, fought through many campaigns.
Did you bring all of them with you to England when you...
I did, yes, you have to. Absolutely.
Yes. You're like a chef with his knives. These are your carving tools.
That's right. No, they're my tools. I'm more attached to them than anything.
When you were given the challenge of filling that space that the Grinling Gibbons carving had filled in Hampton Court, you had been carving on your own and your own work for a long, long time. How did you wrestle with this idea of I would use the word recreating, but filling the space may be a better way of mm-hmm. describing what you had to do mm-hmm. there, because you were no longer saying, this is what I want to do. It's what was there before.
It was a real jolt, and it was sort of an existential decision. I was, at that point, when the fire happened, I was kind of blocked in my own work, in that I felt like a kind of parasite on Gibbons. I had been in Gibbons' shadow from the moment I started carving. And it was beginning to be oppressive. I mean, I was thinking to myself, well, why am I doing this? Gibbons has done this much better than I can. I mean, I was trying to pour new wine in the old bottles, and I was, I discarded some of his archaisms. But then I thought that the fire would give me an opportunity to sort of exorcise the ghost, to lay the ghost to rest. If I were to just become Gibbons, fleeing from Gibbons, but just take him on, wear the wolf's clothing, then maybe somehow, by some means which I didn't understand, I would be able to escape from him. And I think it worked, but not in the way that I expected it would.
What happened that you hadn't expected?
Well, in the end, I was using as a metaphor this beautiful painting in the Metropolitan Museum that shows, it's by Poussin, it shows Orion, the giant, with a little human figure on his shoulder. And over the years, many people have used that as a metaphor for how you can rest on the shoulders of great predecessors and you can see further than they can, for example. And it's hard to summarize the story, but in the end, I realized that was not the metaphor, that actually the great giant that we were both on was the act of making itself, that Gibbons had ridden on the shoulder where I had ridden, that that it wasn't a matter of my being in his shadow as much as our both, to say it arrogantly, being colleagues in the same endeavor. It's an old anxiety of influence problem with what do you do with a great predecessor? And I think in the end, you kind of turn them to your purpose. You get from them what you can. You invite them into the workshop. You work together. And there came a point in the middle of my year at Hampton Court, which I talk about in the book, where somehow I had reached a stage where I didn't think I was on his shoulder, but he was on my shoulder. He was a monkey on my shoulder. But he jumped off, and he just became another character among the other characters at Hampton Court. And I think that was probably the way forward for me.
This happened now almost 30 years ago, 25, yeah, I guess.
Yes.
What effect has it had on your work since then?
Well, I think I've become a better carver, of course, because I found, I stole everything I could from Gibbons during the time.
And stealing is very important.
Absolutely. Actually. Stealing ruthlessly. No, he had many tricks, which I picked up. But then, I had the confidence, I think, to just move on to different territory. So I'm doing things which Gibbons would never have done, would never have dreamed of doing, different forms and different methods.
We just have a minute left. Can you tell us what people will see if they come to your gallery to see the work that you have here?
Well, they'll see probably higher relief carvings than they've seen before. They'll see carved elements which they have not seen. They'll see carved heads which are made up of flowers and fruits.
Like Hieronymus Bosch paintings?
Or like Giuseppe Arcimboldo.
Fruit-faced
people.
Yes.
And other forms which I hope I've poured new wine in the old bottle.
Well, David Easterly, thank you so much. It's lovely to talk to you about both history and ideas and making things.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure.
I've been speaking with woodcarver David Easterly about the year he spent recreating a destroyed wood carving by the artist whose work inspired him to become a carver. His memoir is called The Lost Carving, A Journey to the Heart of Making. It's published by Viking. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.